Hi everyone, this is Jason / Udvernoki.
And I'm Peter Surplus Gamer Silk.
And I'm Karem / Crumbs.
And if Chris the Tingler Cable were here, he'd probably introduce himself right about now. But he's not here, is he, Peter? Where's Chris?
No, so he won't. Where is he? I don't know. Probably dead.
Probably is dead. I mean, I didn't want... I'll be honest, I knew he was dead. He was tragically caught in a threshing machine. I just didn't want to bring it up and get everyone all upset. Yeah. Way to go. You insensitive ass. But
yeah, you insensitive ass.
Yes. So, yeah. What do you say we...
It seems like the sort of thing he would do, so,
yeah,
you know.
True.
Good guess.
Well, what do you say we talk about Tales of Monkey Island Chapter 4, The Trial and Execution of Guybrush Threepwood? I think Chris would have liked it that way.
Let's do that.
Okay. How'd the game treat you guys?
Someone else
Peter?
Talk first.
All right. I loved it. I thought it was one of the best. It's one of the best games I've played in the last 5 years. Not just any adventure game either. Just one of the best games I've ever had the pleasure to experience. I'm not exaggerating.
Well, I certainly think it is. Of the quality of the previous episodes, which was high. You know, it's really hard for me to sort of review these games because, I mean, it's like at this point, it's so well established that it's like Telltale has it down. You don't really expect them to mess it up. So when you get a new episode, it's kind of like just what you'd expect in terms of, you know, the quality being there and them capturing the spirit of the license, right? So what I would say about Chapter 4 is that it's more of the same, but I mean that in the best way possible.
And yet you say that, but it was my job to review this episode, and I was...
You were paid well
for it,
too.
I was joking about it beforehand, saying, "Oh, we haven't got the review copy yet. Why don't I just copy out everything that we said about episode 3 and reword it a bit, and then post that, and that'll be the review?" Because, you know, I was really confident that I would like it as much, or at least nearly as much, as the previous episode, which I loved, and I didn't like it as much.
Fair enough. Let's hear about it.
I was surprised. And I think the main problem, the best way I can describe my problem with it is it's all to do with the pacing of it. And there are kind of three main bits of plot exposition in it. There's some at the beginning, and then there's a big sort of thing in the middle, and then you get another big thing at the end.
Yeah,
and
certainly, as far as the plot is concerned, a lot happens in this episode. This is a very... This episode...
Yeah.
Moves a lot.
Yeah, a lot happens, but it's all in these sort of confined plot bubbles, and the stuff in between just seems like an excuse to sort of pry these plot bubbles apart. Like, it became really noticeable in the second half of a game where you sort of get the voodoo shopping list of things that you need to collect in order to make the sponge. Make the sponge big again, and that's all that the second half of the game is, basically. I just feel like there's no finesse to that. There's none of the what you have to do slowly revealing itself to you, and there's no real plot development while this is happening. It's just this slog of getting all these items and putting them together, and it kind of feels arbitrary to me. Like, they could have replaced those five odd puzzles with completely different puzzles and not changed the story at all. It kind of irritated me that in a game where the story was such a big point, so it was so important, which it was in this episode, that most of the plot itself was just combined to these really quick, maybe 5 minute moments at the beginning, middle and end, and the rest was just ticking off checklists of things that you had to do.
So if I'm understanding you right, you're saying that you felt that the actual gameplay was kind of detached from the story. Like, you'd solve puzzles, but then you felt that when it came time for the story to progress, it would just happen in like a cutscene, and then you would just be on to your next puzzle. Is that how you, what are you trying to say?
Yeah, I didn't. I think that episode 3, the puzzles and the story, even though there was less story, the puzzles and the story were really well integrated together. In this one, I felt that it was just, you got story, then a bunch of puzzles, and then story, and then a bunch of puzzles, and the puzzles could have been anything. They just chucked a bunch of puzzles in, and then finally you got some story again.
Jason, you go ahead.
Well, when you say Chapter 3 had a lot less story, I mean, it had a lot less story. I mean, the whole game took place inside the bowels of the manatee, so, you know...
Yeah, I think it did have a lot less story.
It's not hard to be story... It's not hard to have puzzles that are story-driven when the entire story is get out of the manatee, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was more than that.
Yeah, but think about how it told the story. That's my point. It had a lot less story, but it told it so much better. Like, you'd have these little moments that happened in amongst the puzzles, like Morgan getting increasingly cross with Guybrush as she saw what he was doing with the puzzles, and that was a big part of the story, that sort of character development there, and the sort of various changes that Murray went through as he went through the story, and you solved various puzzles. It felt more natural. It felt like the minimal story that was there was being developed gradually as the puzzles went on, and it wasn't just being delivered to you in a big lump every so often.
That's fair enough. I mean, I think there, Chapter 4 probably has more character development than any previous episode, but then I think I get what you're saying. Like, when it comes time to, you know, when LeChuck makes a big revelation about midway or two-thirds of the way through, you can go find out about it, but it basically comes down to, you know, talking to him and the voodoo lady and going through a bunch of dialogue trees. You're saying that. You're saying that the storytelling and the puzzle solving kind of went together better in Lair of the Leviathan.
Yeah, and I'd say even in all the episodes, I think the storytelling and the puzzles are being combined better. To me, it was just really conspicuous how, I used the word before, but I'll use it again, how arbitrary the puzzles seemed when I was playing through them. And that was my main problem with the game. And I had some positives about it, because some of the puzzles I thought were really clever. I did enjoy some of the puzzles. But I was just less impressed with this episode than I expected to be going in. That was my only thing. I did end up enjoying it. By the end, I was smiling and really looking forward to the next one. But I think it seemed to me to be, at least puzzle-wise, a step backwards.
Well, I didn't have the same problem you did, but, I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, you know, that the design maybe felt more refined for Chapter 3 for you. It seems to me that you kind of had similar problems with Siege of Spinner K, right? That was also more of a self-proclaimed sprawling episode. You know, Well, go ahead. You were trying to say.
Yeah, I felt it did have some design issues in that there were too many locations and not enough puzzles for the locations. It didn't have very good economy of designs. It was kind of all spread out, and the only reason for it to be spread out was to make one or two of the puzzles work. And so I had that problem with the puzzle design of that, but overall I still thought it was a decently designed episode. I didn't think there were really any big pacing issues with that one, but I just thought that the gameplay bits of this one genuinely weren't as fun. But just to name a couple of the puzzles that I did really enjoy for balance, even though it kind of drove me nuts that there was another jungle map puzzle, I did like the jungle map puzzle this time. I thought it was very clever.
Yeah, they managed to introduce a new spin on it each time.
Yeah. I thought it was a really cleverly designed little puzzle that, even though it didn't take me any time at all to figure out what was going on, I found it satisfying to do. The other one that stuck out for me was the sort of set piece in the middle of trying to set things up to serve the summons to Elaine to court.
You mean the one where you try to convince her? Are you talking about the one where you try to convince her? Well, you try to give her the during the fight where you try to get her to stab the dartboard.
Yeah, that one there. Yeah, it's one of those. They seem to be doing a lot of those in this series, having these set piece puzzles where you're in a confined location for a little bit, like the chair with the monkey in the first episode, and you just need to think things through to get yourself out of that situation or to succeed in that situation. And I think they do that style of puzzle really well at Telltale.
You know what's interesting? You go ahead, Jason.
I really love the music in this episode. Like, the music's been consistently great, and I don't think this one's, like, better than the other ones, but it's just, like, you know, I was really appreciating Michael Land's work, you know, while I was walking across the island and, you know, going into the bar. You know, there's a lot of nods to the scores of the past games.
It was all really good work.
It just really made me realize how integral that is to establishing the tone of these games. It's like, if you took away that music, it would be a lot.
Although, and I don't... and I don't want to sound too negative here, but I did notice a few kind of conspicuously odd reuses of music in this one. For example, you know the music when you're diving down to the floor in Chapter 3 that's from the old games? At one point, that's used as a sort of victory success music when you take care of the plant, I think, and there's no real good reason for that bit of music to be there. It just seemed like they needed a victory music sting, so they shoved that in there, but it doesn't really make sense in that situation.
What did y'all think of Stan?
Just like ignore Stan for a second, I just wanted to say that what's really nice about Michael Land's music is the fact that you're not very it's there. It's very beautiful music, even outside the context of the game, but you don't actually think, oh man, like, this is a really good piece of music during the gameplay. It's not distracting. It actually is very well integrated into whatever it is you're doing at that moment of time, which is something that I can't think of a single other composer, like, maybe Peter McConnell, but who does that really, really well?
I agree that a strength of it is that it doesn't call attention to itself. It just kind of does its job, and, like, you know, you don't really notice it.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you listen. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, you finish.
Yeah, it's just like if you eat, like, it's noticeable enough that during the end credits it's playing, and you're like, oh yeah, that's the Marquis music. That's, you know, the music that was playing at the Jerkbeat Islands, but. During the actual gameplay, it's just like part of the background. It's just there, and it never bothers you, pretty as it is.
Mm.
I
agree.
Yeah. And as for Stan, Jason, you wanted to say something?
No.
Okay. As for Stan, I really, really like Stan. Maybe there was just a little part of me that was thinking maybe he should have been a little bit more animated or a little bit more... like, his voice wasn't, I guess, boomy enough. The way I imagine Stan is more like Zap Brannigan from Futurama. Yeah. But it didn't bother me. It was really... It worked. It's not perfect, but it worked.
I think they captured Stan well, and it's you know, I loved when he showed up. It did feel a little obligatory, but then Stan showing up in the first place is kind of obligatory. You know, there's not much you can, you know, I would never suggest making a Monkey Island game without Stan. But he's more comparable to Murray in Escape from Monkey Island than Murray in Tales of Monkey Island in his use. I mean, he's definitely not as superficial as Murray was in EMI because he's integral to puzzles, but like his actual role could have been filled by anybody, you know? It didn't have to be Stan. Yeah. It was Stan because you needed to see him. It's not really a complaint. Yeah, sort of an observation that this is sort of the thing that happens when you have to go out of your way to please the fan base. I'm glad they didn't.
I mean, he was there. You know, he was done well. I think like you said, he's the new voice. It's another one that's kind of almost but not quite, but it's good enough.
I felt
it's
that
voice.
Way. I will say though, I felt that way about all his voices so far though.
Yeah. I think it's been a running thing, and
Jacket.
You know he's just there and he's implemented fine. Yes. He's not as essential as Murray was in the previous episode, but he's done well, and they don't just waste him on an arbitrary thing. So there's just not really much that you can really say about him. that's all.
I guess Stan's about as I guess Stan's about as essential in this one as he was in Curse, just because like also his role in Curse, I think he gives you a death certificate, right? It could have been fulfilled by anybody. It would not have been as funny, but so maybe Curse, like, okay, Curse is not, it's not exactly like Curse. It's I guess it's a little bit more. What I'm trying to say is, like, Stan showing up in Tales has been as well an integration as they could have put him in that particular game.
I agree. I'm not saying he felt any less perfunctory in any of the other games. That's almost sort of the point. It's just like, you know, eventually Stan has got to show up. It's just sort of an observation I was making.
No. Yeah, yeah.
What about, okay, so we did end up returning to Flotsam Island, like we pretty much all suspected. What did you guys think about, you know, revisiting the same island and how they handled it?
I didn't have a problem with it. I thought it was actually kind of nice to return to that location at this point in the series. And I liked the attention to detail in the way they made it at night, and the color palette of it. How there were the recognizable blues and yellows that you'd see on Melee Island in the first game, and it sort of was a callback to that I liked. And so no, it didn't really bother me that it was set there.
And I like the fact that it pays off and resolves a lot of things that happens in episode one. You know, in a lot of ways, this episode feels like a denouement. I mean, we do have one more episode left, so there's more story to tell. But, you know, you get to see everyone cured of the pox. A lot of the conflict that is established in Launch of the Screaming Narwhal is resolved in this episode. And so...
Yeah.
And even though you do revisit a lot of the same locations, we still got to see the interior of the courthouse. We still got to see the bar, the interior of Club 41. So there was still enough new to mix in with the old. And I made this point in the last podcast. This is something that happens a lot in Monkey Island games anyway, where you kind of revisit an island.
Yeah.
I didn't mind it at all.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, actually, wonder.
No, I thought it was fine for...
Yeah, Peter, go ahead.
All right. To be honest, I thought that they might just have it on Flotsam as part of the episode and spend maybe most of the episode somewhere else, but once the episode got going, it didn't really bother me that the whole thing took place there.
Yeah.
I love the way it looked.
It works. I just want to see
why
it works.
Sucks.
Yeah, no worries, man. Go ahead.
It's just more appealing when environments are shown at night. Telltale games, they tend to look... The environments, the interiors and the night environments always tend to look a little bit better than the...
the lighting is better. Yeah.
This kind of goes with what I was saying earlier about the music, but, you know, I just feel like Telltale really captured the atmosphere of the series really well. I mean, all the Monkey Island games take place in the same universe, but they all kind of have their own... interpretation of it, and Monkey Island has always sort of juggled between existing in this sort of realistic slash fantastical pirate world, supernatural pirate world, but there's also this element of sort of the wackier, funnier
more like
Disneyland
the
ride
of
aspect of it. And I think Telltale has kind of chosen to veer more towards the farmer aesthetic, more towards the just kind of, this could work as a genuine, legitimate pirate story, you know, without the demonic carnivals and the weird, surreal kids' imagination stuff or the Star Buccaneers parodies, you know. I mean, obviously there's an element of that to it. I mean, there's got to be. This is Monkey Island. But I like the way that... I love the tone that they found with Tails. Anyway, just wanted to say that.
I think at first it was a little bit too cartoony for my... Not cartoony, a little bit... like Moose, like I don't know, like surfer dudes don't really fit in with the Monkey Island universe. But on the other hand, like in this chapter, they completely flipped that around. What was her name? The girl at the bar, the one playing with that knife. What's her name? Whatever her name was.
Oh, I can't remember either.
Katie, Kathy, something like that.
She had a really weird name. But
it was a weird name.
I like the Full Throttle reference.
Yeah, I love that too.
Oh, but, yeah.
What I'm trying to say is, like, on the one hand, you do have Moose or Noogie or whatever. And on the other, like, next chapter you have her, which is, like, she's a complete... do you know, like, in the opening of Monkey Island 2, where there's this drawing of, like, three or four pirates holding up a bunch of gold?
Maybe?
Like, they're... Yeah, well, like that to me is what a Monkey Island game should be—that piratey thing—and she brought that back into Tails. Like, not just her; it's the whole Flotsam thing, especially during this chapter. But yeah, I mean, like, that sort of exemplifies what you were talking about, which is flitting between that Disneyland look and that sort of—you know—it's a true pirate story, but at the same time, there is that element of the wacky sort of more carnival than
right.
Dam kind of thing.
There's this sort of element to the series where, like, it sort of is self-aware. It sort of knows that it doesn't take place in a real world.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But
I think the games are at their best when that aspect is handled in a more jokey, you know, tongue-in-cheek aspect. Because at the end of the day, you want to play a game that takes itself takes its world seriously enough that it's believable and it's rich, you know.
Well, that's another reason why I thought it was slightly... because so much kind of serious stuff happens in this episode.
Yeah, it's
true. That's why I would have liked more time for that to breathe across the length of the episode rather than have it have these sort of isolated pockets of serious kind of and kept apart by these sort of whimsical puzzles. If they'd have found a way to bring those plot points more into what you were doing as you solved these puzzles, then I think it would have been it would have given it even more weight than it has. But I did enjoy the direction that they took the plot in this.
Yeah,
you know,
I enjoyed the plot. Go ahead, Krams. Go ahead.
Sorry, Jason. I wanted to say this earlier too that I disagree with you on the puzzles not being part of whatever, the puzzles not being part of the plot. Just because if you think about it, like, this is a really cheap analogy, but if you try to, cheap example, but if you try to adapt Tales into a book, for example, and you try to write in that whole scene with the, the face puzzle, it wouldn't have really worked, whereas a scene where Guybrush is trying to make this little sponge work so that he can cure his wife and everyone else he's infected, you know, it is integrated into the storyline. I mean, it's not something that just happens without any reason. Whereas I think you could have.
I'm not saying it happens. I'm not saying that it happens without any apparent reason. I'm saying that it is while you're busy collecting all these ingredients, which, I mean, it could have been any task that you were set to do, really, to make the sponge big. It could the puzzles themselves are what's so arbitrary about it. It's just like, well, we need to waste some time to get between the middle and the end of the plot, so let's give Guybrush a load of tasks that will eventually make the sponge big. So you know that nothing's going to happen until you've done this shopping list of tasks. And having that as half the game, it sort of sticks out rather conspicuously to me.
Have you guys ever read those narrative walkthroughs that LucasArts used to publish with their hint books? I bring it up because Kroms was talking about what you might have to do if you tried to adapt one of these into a novel, and that's kind of exactly what they did. They would basically write the game out in first person as like a first person short story as told by, you know, Dave Miller or Indiana Jones. Or Bob and Threadbare, whatever.
You mean like the Secret History ones you put up? Or I think you're
right. Those come from the hit books.
Okay.
Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. I just thought it was, because it's funny watching them try to like write in a reason for them to, you know, do some of the things they do in these games. I think that was one of the major criticisms of the Dig novel. It was basically like an adaptation of the game where they somehow tried to justify logically like why Boston Low would be doing all these ridiculous things that the game has him doing. Well, speaking of the story,
yes,
I enjoy it. I really like the plot and tales, and I like how it's kind of more twisty and turny than the previous games. I'm so surprised, though, that nobody is calling it out on the Pirates of the Caribbean similarities. All of the key storylines in this game are like come from the Pirates of the Caribbean sequels. Am I alone in thinking this?
Give
me an example here.
LeChuck turning human, LeChuck stabbing Guybrush for him to presumably come back as a supernatural entity, the love triangle, the voodoo lady's romance represented by the locket. I mean, there's so much.
I don't even remember some of this stuff from Pirates of the Caribbean.
I bring it up because especially
the first couple of things.
Well, when the Pirates movies came out, you know, we all made our comments about how similar they were to Monkey Island, and we started, you know, Shipwreck Cove is Woodtick, and, you know, Beckett controlling Davy Jones is like Ozzy controlling LeChuck, and I'm just surprised nobody has pointed out, you know, how Tails seems to be borrowing an awful lot from those movies.
Well, in my defense, I do not remember. Like, the Pirates 2 and Pirates 3 were so terrible that I've tried and apparently succeeded at forgetting them. There was nothing that redeemed those two films, especially that ending. Somebody mentioned something on the Telltale forum about how the voodoo lady in Pirates of the Caribbean turns into a pirate god or something, and I don't remember that. But if what you're saying is true, then that would, like, I'm not gonna lead into discussion on chapter 5, but it does make. So maybe you're right. Like, it depends, I guess, on what happens when Chapter 5 comes out.
Maybe, I guess. It just hasn't been that conspicuous to me, that side of things. And maybe it's just because I don't really care enough about the Pirates of the Caribbean films. I just haven't really noticed it much. It seems to me to be a different entity. I mean, back when people were comparing Pirates of the Caribbean to certain things from Monkey Island, at the time I thought, oh yeah, that is kind of interesting how this thing is a little bit like this thing, but it's kind of incidental. I don't think there's any real major significance to it. Some of it might be a reference, yeah, but it's, I mean, whatever. And I kind of feel the same about this. They don't really feel like the same thing to me, so if they've got some similarities, then that doesn't bother me.
Well, I'm pretty sure I said it didn't bother me. I just think it's interesting that, you know, you had all this discussion about it for pirates.
Yeah.
But now that Monkey Island seems to be having very similar, you know, a very similar relationship, you're not hearing that at all. I just thought that was interesting.
Well, I
okay,
think
well, if
on
you
that.
Are listening to this and you are... Sorry.
Sorry, I guess I must have like a few seconds delay on my my version of Skype here. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
I think you do. Yeah. I was just gonna say that if you are listening to this and you are someone who is bothered by these similarities, then stick your head in a bucket of water and try and hold your breath for 10 minutes.
And go buy a Vampire Story.
That is my advice.
I should get around to buying that. Actually, there was somebody on, I think, yeah, it's Scoville, on the Mix and Mojo, the Mix and Mojo comments. It's on the story God Rest His on Trial right
comments.
Now, where he's like, it's similar to the Matrix and. It's similar to the Matrix and Pirates of the Caribbean, but the way it's written and executed make it different and emotional and very interesting. Which now that I think about, I do see some similarities, but I have to agree with Escobar or Igor, that okay, like it's like the it's you know do you know how in Monkey Island in Pirates of the Caribbean 1 it did feel a lot like. The first Monkey Island game, but at the same time it didn't. Does that make any sense?
I mean, what it was a great pirate movie, and like that it never, you know, there are. I don't know when the last great pirate movie was. I think that's basically the thing.
No, like that's not what I meant. What I meant was. Like, okay, they do have some similarities. The more that I think about it, the more I realize you're right. But it does not feel the same, and I think that's pretty essential. It's sort of like Escape from Monkey Island. It was a Monkey Island game. It did have the right music. It did have the right puzzles. And for the most, like, large parts of it, the humor. But... it didn't have the spirit that was the spirit of Monkey Island, which I think is part of the reason it wasn't as well received as the others. And I think Tales compares that way to Pirates of the Caribbean in that, sure, it has a lot of the same elements, but the emotions and the spirit and the entire atmosphere is completely different.
Well, I don't think anybody would disagree that the spirit is different. Mm. I mean, I'm talking about superficial things that are interesting to observe. I'm not, you know, saying
anything
more than
that. Oh, yeah, sure, you are. Sure, you're, that's what you're saying, but, you know, I've seen comments of other people who...
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm the only person I know of who's made the comment at all about the similarity. That I know of. I don't frequent the comments or the forums as much as maybe I should.
I'm pretty sure that I've seen other people with their tinfoil hats on about this, you know, and
But for the most recent episode?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry, no, not for the most recent episode. I haven't really seen much discussion about that yet, but about various other superficial things that have happened, you know, in the previous episodes. I couldn't tell you what they are.
There was a couple of comments this morning on the Telltale forums, but I couldn't, like, I could try to find them for you, but I would probably fail. I wanted to ask, what did you guys think I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead. I guess I must have a really bad lag here.
You do seem to be lagging quite a way. I've forgotten what I was going to say, so you might as well just go ahead.
Sorry. My question was, what did you guys think about the Marquis dying? It was, a lot of people were complaining, oh, it's not dark enough. And then that scene happened, and it was very, nothing like that had happened in a Monkey Island game before, or for outside of Grim Fandango in a LucasArts Plus adventure game.
I thought it was pretty similar to how Ozzy got crushed by the giant Stone LeChuck at the end of Escape. You know,
yeah.
I really liked Marquis as a character, but it was, I'm kind of glad that LeChuck regained the throne of the ultimate villain, because like Marquis was a really interesting and unique and memorable villain, but he wasn't strong enough to be like an arch villain.
Yeah.
So they kind of needed to get him out of the
way. He's a lightweight, really. Yeah.
Right. There was a lot of cleanup being done in this episode. We kind of like Marquis is done. You know, we got to get rid of Morgan so Elaine and Guybrush can get back together. And part five, like it seems like most of the resolving has been done now at the end of this episode, and that, you know, the last chapter is going to be like more of a giant epilogue, a giant showdown climax.
I don't know. I don't know that it's any different to what they've done before. Well, at least since they've started making the episodes more, their episodic games more kind of integrated, which I guess is really since the first
Second
Sam and Max series, because first one had a sort of overarching arc to it,
I agree with you.
The second one even more so, yeah. Yeah, the second one is even more so, yes, you're right. And so I expected a lot of stuff to get resolved at this episode 4 or 5 point, because you have to do that to set things up, set up a nice ramp into the final episode. It's at this point in any, if it was a longer game with bits stuck together, or if it was a film or something, it would be about this point in the film or game, about 4/5 of the way through, where you'd have to start bringing things to a head and go into your so that most of the actual plot has been tied up, and then go into your climax, where there might be one or two more things revealed, but most of the main action of what has come before has been resolved.
Well, Peter, you were the one who always suspected and always hoped that eventually LeChuck would, you know, turn out, you know, would eventually show his true colors. So how did you feel about the ending? Were you happy about it?
Yeah, I was. The whole ending part of the game was my favorite bit, really. Things happened, I don't know, they didn't happen exactly the way that I imagined them,
right.
But but on the other hand, I wasn't really surprised by anything, but then again, it did satisfy me. It really did satisfy me to see sort of the return of LeChuck, and
Earl
to
Bowen.
See, indeed, yes.
Yeah.
That was a surprise to me, certainly. But not only to see the return of LeChuck, but I think I would have been even more disappointed. And this is not to say I'm extremely disappointed, but I would have been more disappointed in this episode if Guybrush had not died at the end.
Right.
And I'm very glad that that happened, because that has made me very excited for the next game and to see what they're going to do about that.
Well, I'm really glad that they went the way they did with LeChuck revealing himself to have been kind of playing everyone all along, because once LeChuck brought up that voodoo book, the diary where the voodoo lady supposedly lays out all of her grand plans, that really kind of rubbed me the wrong way. We were getting a little bit too close to Lost style, H.T. Marley style, unnecessary canon shattering revelations in a series that doesn't really call for it. But we'll see where they go with that. But I think at that point in the game, LeChuck kind of taking his spot, rightful spot back was very good.
And I fully expected it to happen even by that point, because you know the conversation that you have with him, but even after everything that had happened in that episode, it just seemed to me that suddenly Guybrush was too friendly with LeChuck in the jail cell.
This is the episode where he finally got won over by LeChuck. You know, he'd always been the pessimistic one.
But I realized
all of a sudden he's his absolute best friend, and I thought, and as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, they're definitely setting Guybrush up for a fall.
What's really nice about this one is that it reveals that LeChuck's evil with or without that pox, and like it's almost like the pox is like some superfluous goo, which is really like, again, I wanted to get back into this, but what I really like about Tails is how much it relies on its characters, and like how much it reveals about its characters, and LeChuck's this particular twist about LeChuck that he's willing to do all of this just for like for getting married, really, was pretty amazing. Same with the Marquis doing all this for science, or Morgan's conflicting feelings about doing what she did to Guybrush, which is why I think the story works as well as it does. Also, I never ever thought that the words "you fight like a dairy farmer" could ever have so much emotional resonance. But the way it was, the way they were used at the end of the game was pretty amazing, I think. Or,
Yeah, I think it was a very strong ending. It was most certainly the strongest ending that any of these episodes have had so far.
Yes.
Yeah, if Chris were here, he'd have something really great to say about this. Always full of life, that guy. But I do think it's kind of weird. Getting like it's great to get Earl Bowen back, but like now, like now we have like all these different voices. Like, you know, we've got the guy who plays the human, who I think is the same guy who originally played his demonic form.
Yeah.
And now we got Earl Bowen mixed in, so it's kind of inconsistent. But on the other hand, I have to say, it didn't sound that different from like actually hearing Earl Bowen, you know, reprising his role as LeChuck. It kind of makes you realize that the first guy really did a pretty decent job
of imitating. I honestly did not know until I watched the credits that that had happened.
There you go.
So there you go.
And the performance as human LeChuck, the guy who does him, he had this Bowen-esque quality to him somehow. Like there was something about how human LeChuck talked that it's like, yeah, that I think that's pretty much how Earl Bowen would have
done it,
played him as a human.
Yeah.
I'd love to know the background story of how Earl Bowen got involved, if they just kept trying to track him down, if they managed to, you know, like, was it just for a line or two? Was it, is he going to be back in the next episode? You know.
So tell us, Jake.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that Earl Bowen does really well that Kevin, I think his name's Kevin Blackton, doesn't, is that the laugh. I realize it was LeChuck. Like, when the screen fades to black, he does his, like, boo-ha-ha, but he does it. It's a very Earl Bowen thing. It's something that the other guy couldn't do at the first episode, where he just goes like, har, har, har. And it felt like Santa Claus joking around, you know what I mean?
Now that you mention it, before I'd read the credits, and with that final laugh at the end going into the credits, the one thing that I did think is, oh, the voice guy has got a better laugh now, that's good.
Yeah.
I liked seeing.
And then I saw that it was actually another actor.
I liked seeing Andrew Chaikin in the credits as well. I saw him in the credits of CSI Deadly Intent, which I've been playing for the review. Well, he's credited as D'Oro. Did he play him in the first episode too?
I think he did. Yeah, he did. I think so.
Okay.
I just wanted to say this. After the first episode came out, I was a little bit, you know, I liked it, but I wasn't really big on all the secondary characters like D'Oro. Whereas in this one, and I'm really happy that Stanley got to do this, which is, but he got to add a lot more to them. Like, even little things like Hemlock feeding his cat, the way he looks at his cat, or it's D'Oro wanting that really, like, D'Oro's such a comic book guy character that, I mean,
they were introduced as caricatures, but, you know, the more time you spend with them, the more opportunity you have to give them a little more.
The best example of that is, like, when the Marquis turns out that he's not French. That, I thought that was hilarious and captured that aspect of Monkey Island pretty well.
Yeah, I think Marquis is going to turn out to be one of the most memorable new characters of Tales.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised.
Jared Emerson Johnson, I don't know, that is just a bizarre, great character.
Yeah. He stole the first episode, and during episodes 3 and 4, he had some really great lines in there. Also, between you and me, I do kind of think that he's going to turn out to be the good guy. Just because they did mention at some point that the part of what the game was exploring was science versus voodoo. And I know that a lot of the key players in this game are very sciencey kind of guys. So I wouldn't be surprised.
No, I don't think he'll turn out to, I'd say he was definitely a villain, but yeah, whether or not he's Morgan's murderer is something I'm still unsure.
Oh no,
he might be.
Yeah.
Though.
Also, he's not really, he's more of the, he's not the good scientist archetype. He's definitely the mad scientist.
Oh
here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's been cutting off the limbs of every pirate in Flossa.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I sort of wanted to, like, I didn't want to see it. He was a good person. I just wanted to say that, I mean, it's interesting what they did with him, just because, like, on one hand, sure, he's doing all these really horrible things, but on the other, I guess I can, like, I don't agree with him, but I guess that there's somebody out there who will think that the ends justify the means, and what the end he's working to, which immortality, I think, within the context of the game, is a pretty big deal, you know what I mean? Like, I don't agree with what he did. I don't agree with cutting off Hemlock's other leg just for the sake of it, but
it's certainly important, this theme of trying to attain immortality, which, by the way, is another something else I would say is a similarity with the pirate sequels. But anyway, I think that's something that's going to come full force into play in the last episode.
Yeah,
with the implications of what just happened. You know, it'll be interesting to see how they. Where they go with it.
A lot of people.
Yeah. Is that a good time to go into speculation then?
Sure.
A lot of people have been saying that the fifth one will be like some sort of afterworld. I'm sorry, my English is a little bit rusty.
Afterlife.
Yeah, afterlife. There you go. And. Like, you have to bring Morgan back and, I don't know, I guess Noogie or something, and the Marquis. And I hope that doesn't happen, just because it devalues whatever emotional resonance you got out of Morgan dying, which we didn't talk about, by the way.
This idea of traversing between two worlds is something that would actually kind of come back to the first two games, the Ron Gilbert, you know,
childlike
vision
thing.
Well, this, you know, the ending of Monkey Island 2 kind of insinuated that
it was really
Ron Gilbert's quote, you know, supposed third game might involve the world of fantasy versus the world of reality, and it kind of made me think of that, this idea that if the fifth episode of Tales brings us into some sort of afterlife, that would sort of be Peter, because I have no idea what I'm trying to say anyway.
Well, I was just saying, did you happen to look at the rug, the voodoo rug in the first episode of the game, and have the voodoo lady give her description of the crossroads and everything like
that?
It seemed to me that this is a lot of information for just looking at a rug. This is interesting, and I think it's going to turn out that is going to have some significance once it gets to the final episode.
It just seems to me that some ideas of where the, you know, alternate Monkey Island 3 might have gone, I think some of that is going to be borrowed for this finale and kind of shaped for Tales purposes. But I think some of those ideas that Monkey Island 1 and 2 were playing at are going to be applied somehow.
Well, they did say that Ron Gilbert's influence is most heavily felt in the final episode, so
yes.
Maybe that's what they're alluding to there. Mm.
Well, Kroms brought up the point that we didn't really address Morgan's death. That was another, you know, there were three deaths in this episode.
Yeah.
Kind of
there
dark.
Were.
But,
Do you know what made that scene for me? It wasn't really, like, okay, her dying was pretty sad because I really liked her, but it was if you examine things after she's gone, like when she's dead, if you, say you examine the books, the chemicals above the Marquis' desk or something, Garbus is like, you know, I should probably not combine these together because it'll cause an explosion and not the funny kind. And it's like very quiet and very sad, and it adds a lot of
I think they realized that in that room it would probably be inappropriate to do lots of kind of whimsical jokey things, and that maybe the humor, that there was were still a few jokes, but maybe the humorous observations
right.
in that room should probably be more subdued to fit the mood. So that was a good bit of another good bit of attention to detail there.
It reminds me a lot of the way actually the very first Sam X episode that Telltale made, Culture Shock, when Max is kidnapped and Sam has to save him, and you know that it's kind of like the last stretch of the game, and when you have Sam try to interact with an object, he'll just be like, you know, that's not Max, that makes me miss Max.
Yeah.
It's sort of an interesting way to let you know what a character is thinking through the mechanics,
yeah.
you know, through the standard mechanics of the game,
yeah.
interacting with the
yeah.
environment.
And even after Morgan's body disappears, I wonder what that's about. After the body disappears, there's still kind of a subdued atmosphere to that place, and I think it works really well. I think that room, going into that room, really reminded me of some of the creepier locations in some of the older games, where you just get this kind of atmospheric, they've just kind of got this atmospheric tingle to them, and I liked the way that whole scene was handled.
Guybrush
finding the fatally wounded Morgan reminded me a lot of the scene in Grim Fandango when
Manny Lupe?
Finds Lupe. Was it Lupe?
Yeah, it was Lupe.
I thought Lupe was the.
Oh no, Lupe was the girl behind. Yeah, Lupe was the coat hanger. Yeah, it was. I forget her name. It's something with an L.
Lola.
Was it Lola?
Lola.
Lola.
It reminded me a lot of
yeah.
that scene. You know.
Yeah, I think yeah that. That is
wanting
a
revenge.
Pretty good observation.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite as finessed as that, but it was effective nonetheless.
I'd be interested. I know that Morgan has deservedly gained a following among a lot of fans, and I'm wondering how they're going to react to this if they feel like you know, this character has just been tossed off because she's not needed anymore. But I think even if you know, I know we've already put forth the theory that we haven't necessarily seen the last of Morgan given the turn that
yeah.
the fifth episode is going to take. But I will say that Morgan's inclusion has been really, really important in further developing the relationship between Guybrush and Elaine. You know, we have a much different understanding of their relationship than we did before Morgan was around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know that scene at the end?
But I do have
stupid delay.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Here's what's more relevant, I can tell. Go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say I do get this feeling that her. I mean, it sounds kind of cold to put it in these terms, but I do have a feeling that she's sort of served her purpose in
right.
the story now, and I would be okay with her not showing up again. I would be okay if she was gone permanently now. I think she was a really great character to have in this series. She served a purpose really well, but I don't think that I wouldn't be annoyed if she came back, but I don't think that she's necessarily kind of needed anymore.
Well, I think I agree. I think she's there to serve a function. She was there to make us learn something or about Guybrush, you know, for Guybrush to, you know, in other words, her inclusion kind of changed the way Guybrush thinks a little bit, and you know, I think as a character she does work and she is strong, but you know, I wouldn't bring her back for the sake of it.
I just wanted to add that a lot of people think that Morgan dying has a lot to do with the rope. I'm sorry, my English, with the robot disappearing off of the Flotsam docks. I just wanted to point out to any listeners that that little robot actually sunk. You can click on it, and Guybrush comments that the pox-infected pirates probably did it. But speaking of Elaine and Guybrush and Morgan, you know, there's been a lot of comments on the Telltale forums about Morgan being more of a better fit to Guy. Like, even when they voted for it,
right,
Morgan actually won out by 7 votes, but she did win out. And after her death, and, you know, after her death and Guybrush's death also, Elaine completely redeems herself, and she reaffirms why she was such a lovable and memorable character in the first place, I think. It's not just the way she reacts to his death, which also adds a lot to it, but I don't know, it just reaffirms their strong relationship, I think.
Right. Morgan was basically invented and sacrificed to strengthen the relationship between Guybrush and Elaine, you know.
Yeah, well, she was a plot device too.
What you were saying though, that she was like kind of modeled specifically to be like a better fit for Guybrush, it was obviously what they were thinking when they created her, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, in many ways, she's kind of a tragic character.
Yes.
She does. I really like Morgan. Part of the reason I like her so much is how she... I mean, Guybrush does break her heart maybe 2 or 3 times in chapters 3 and 4. The last one being the time he tells her off at the bar. And I think that, like, sometimes it almost seems to me that Morgan is everything Guybrush wants to be. Like, she's a really renowned and really feared pirate. She's, she's got a lot of skill. She's got a lot of style. She's, you know, she gets the job done. And whereas Guybrush is, you know, clumsy little guy. And they got rid of that. But I'm sorry, I'm mumbling. But at the same time, my English is kind of rusty at this point. I haven't spoken it in 5 months. But do you know the bar fight scene? I really like it for a few reasons, most telling of which it shows that Elaine and Morgan are very evenly matched, if that makes any sense. And like, in a way, it also relates to how Guybrush relates to both of them. You know what I mean?
No, I think all this is absolutely... I mean, you can make so many observations about Morgan as a character and how she's a foil, a shadow, a companion for Guybrush. You know, there's a lot of, I think, comparisons to be made between those two characters and kind of why she exists and her significance. I mean, that's what's so great about her existing. I mean, it kind of shook things up a little bit in the series as far as things we... You know, things that maybe were... You know, the relationship between Guybrush and Elaine... There might not necessarily have been anything wrong with it, but it wasn't necessarily the strongest bond ever.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of room to tell a story, and I think Telltale has really done a great job of exploiting that potential.
Yeah. Do you know that scene where she starts talking in court? Like, you know, he turned me into a statue, he did this and that. Sometimes, like, it just occurred to me right now that the Pox is sort of the Mr. Hyde sort of everybody. It's like the Mr. Hyde side of everyone, and that she really actually feels this way, and the Pox sort of lets her actually take it out, which brings us back to Jason's point that, you know, that the relationship is a little bit flaky, that a lot of people would almost say unbelievable. Considering the end of MI2,
I wonder whether she would have won out against Morgan in that fight if she hadn't been pumped up on all those poxy steroids.
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you know what I wonder about? I wonder.
But yeah, I mean, I think that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Peter. Go ahead. Stupid lag.
I think you'd have a point about. About how it probably there's some truth to the poxy versions of people. It's not just it's not simply being infused with LeChuckness. It's more like it emphasizes all of the kind of negative sides of their character.
Yeah. Right, and I think that's what's so important about the revelation that LeChuck, yeah, he is evil with or without the pox.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that he chooses to become a zombie again. I thought that was very important and very that he actually makes a choice of sticking his hand into the sponge, and he has no qualms whatsoever about stabbing Guybrush in front of his wife.
And what's so great is that he redeems himself by as a villain by being so irredeemable. Because I think some of the things, you know, some people have accused some of the previous Monkey Island games of kind of cheapening LeChuck as a villain, making him a little bit less nefarious, a little bit more of a cartoony villain. And it's kind of nice to see LeChuck do the kind of just genuinely and thoroughly nasty things he does in this episode, just sort of reaffirming, like, yeah, this is the LeChuck we know. He's not just some buffoon who's doing all these crazy voodoo things to get revenge. I mean, he is, but he's also just
he runs Guybrush right through and smiles as he does it. You know,
yes.
You can't get any better than that, or worse, yes. Maybe.
Also, that unholy bit, this bit at the end, that was like the line at the beginning at chapter one. It was like, eh, like, you know, it's amusing, I guess. But they took that very line and switched it around. They gave it a completely new and different meaning, and it really became kind of sad to see Guybrush being given a really good dose of his own medicine. Especially, like, I'm reading too much into this, I think, but especially considering that Guybrush taught LeChuck how to do that kind of thing in chapter two.
I was amazed at how well the serious scenes worked. You know, because when Guybrush gets stabbed and he's dying, you know, they do make a little joke. He makes some remark about, you know, Mom, I've cleaned my hands or something. But it totally works as like a sad, serious scene. And I think it just goes to show that's what the real strength of Monkey Island is. It's got a strong enough, rich enough atmosphere. How am I going to say this? It can support moments like that, despite the fact that it's a comedy, that it's silly, that it's wacky. It's also, you know, a fully realized world with characters in it that you may actually care about, you know? And I just think that
it balances out the tragic with the comic.
A game with a weaker world wouldn't have been able to pull that off.
Yeah.
Like, I think the fact that they were able to pull it off as well as they did, as effectively as they did, is very telling.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think you could balance out that tragic comic moment in Strombad. It just wouldn't work.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, or even in Sam and Max, really.
Well, I mean, Sam and Max, I think the difference between Sam and Max and a lot of the other more, like, I don't want to say more endearing, but I remember at some point I made this controversial remark on the Lucas forums that I thought that Sam and Max Season 2 was as good as, if not better, than Grim Fandango. Which is, okay, maybe I don't really believe that, but I think a lot of the reason why people disagree with me is that Max is very much an immortal character. Like, you don't feel bad, like, you know, they're going to be okay, whereas you don't. You know, you're not sure if Gladys is going to turn out fine at the end. And that sort of relates to what Jason was saying, that you know, Guybrush could very well end up dead or you know, harmed, whereas, you know, Strongbad doesn't really care much beyond his console.
I would fear for my life if I made any kind of comparison to something being better than Grim Fandango. You know, I don't want to end up like Chris. But I will say that Sam and Max Season 2 as a whole, I think, was the telltale game that was like that game, I think, objectively speaking, would sit very comfortably with the best LucasArts put out. Like, that is a that is a game of the kind of quality of the old LucasArts glory days.
Yeah.
Whether people want to admit it or not. I mean, and I think Telltale has only been besting themselves since then.
Yeah.
I think they had, I mean, apart from my reservations that I had earlier on in this, and that you will read, well, the review will be out by the time that you you hear this. Apart from those reservations, I do think that they have done a really, really great job with this series, and I'm very excited for the next one. So I agree with what you said that they're just doing great at the moment.
Yeah,
I find it really hard to talk about these in terms of episodes and like trying to rank episodes, and it's like it's still surreal to me that like when you play these games, you're just so gratified that, wow, we actually got a new Monkey Island game, and it's actually worthy, you know? That still kind of gets me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I know you've spoken before about how to you... I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you were saying that to you it kind of seems much more like it's just a Monkey Island game that's being released in bits, more so than before, and I agree, and it's obvious that it is the most sort of tightly running narrative of any Telltale game so far, but it is still an episodic game, and
it is.
So I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing that we should be scrutinizing each individual part of the episodes as much as we are, and so, you know,
well, it's not scrutinizing it. It's that I would take issue with. It's the fact that, I mean, yeah, they're released and developed as these parts, but they're also all part of the same game. Like when Launch of the Screaming Norwal came out, that was the time where we were like, okay, how does the art direction hold up? The music, and, you know, is the environment work good? And yes,
yeah.
Each episode has its own assets that can be, you know, evaluated whether or not they were better or worse or whatever. I particularly like the music in this episode, et cetera, et cetera. But I think ultimately the groundwork's been laid. Like, you know, at this point it's just like, where's the story going? I mean, yeah, I can point out all the things, all the strengths about the animation and the timing and the puzzles that I like. But I mean, ultimately, like, it's just like waiting for it to finish, really. I mean, it's like you can take it for granted that it's going to continue to be in the same vein of the previous episodes.
Yeah, I guess you can accept that. I mean, and I would sort of agree with that, except that I can't, because I know that when I played through this episode, fully expecting to have the same sort of experience that I'd had in the previous episodes, for whatever reason, I came away from it feeling that it was not as well designed on the in the puzzle department as some of the previous episodes.
Well, that's totally valid. I mean, but what I guess what I would say, my answer to that would be, I might have been playing for one of the previous Monkey Island games. I might have found, you know, the third chapter way worse designed and way less satisfying than the second chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say the same thing about Curse or, you know, Monkey Island 2, whatever.
Yeah, but that was released as a whole game, and you do, and you've got no choice but to judge that as a whole, really.
That's basically what I would have gotten to. Like, it's how it's released. I mean, not really what it is objectively. I mean, you can't help it.
But it's not just how it's released. I mean, it's not just that they decided to make a game and split it up into five parts and then release it with a month apart of each of them. It is consciously designed as an episodic release. It's not quite the same as if they had just split a game into five.
It is consciously designed as an episodic piece, but it was also consciously designed as a single whole. That's the thing. I mean, it was really both at the same time.
That's what I've been trying.
And
yes,
that's kind of true of the other games too. I mean, you could argue that they were also. I mean, you could argue that they were also designed as individual parts that work together as a whole.
Mm. Well, here's what the impression that I got overall, and I'm not sure that this is going to turn out correct because I haven't played the whole of Tales of Monkey Island yet, but I felt, do you have this problem where you replay adventure games and there are just some sections of the game where, because just maybe it's the puzzle design, maybe it's just the setting of it, that you just don't really feel like replaying that part of the game. It's the least entertaining part of the game to replay to you. Do you experience that with
adventure games? Oh, you mean games? What I call the petrified forest syndrome?
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Sure. Yeah. I think that even though I'm going to really love Tales of Monkey Island overall, this chapter is that bit of the game for me.
Oh, and that's perfectly fair enough for me. I mean, I would have no qualms with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your opinion, dude.
I think that, you really wanted to say this, that the games, dude, like, the designers really did a spectacular job of making sure that, the games do work as little chapters, but if you, and I did this a couple of days ago, if you play from chapters 1 to 4, or 1, or 3, whatever, it'll be like you do see a lot of coherent, I don't want to say in jokes, but large parts of chapter one make a lot more sense now that chapter 4 is out.
And that's a storytelling thing, you know, that has to do with plot and,
yeah, but what I mean is
planning things out.
No, but what I mean is, like, you don't need to play Culture Shock to be able to fully appreciate Abe Lincoln Must Die, but you can't play Spinner K without playing Screaming Narwhal. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I just wanted to say that you're kind of both correct, that it is an episodic game, but at the same time, it really works as a full overlong adventure.
Here's one last thing I want to say on this, Peter. Just so you don't misunderstand me. I fully acknowledge the fact that Tales of Monkey Island was, from a production standpoint, to some extent from a design standpoint, it was not made the same way as the other games. But I think it mostly has to do with the way it's delivered. You know, I think at the end of the day, a lot of the things that people find inherent to episodic when they evaluate Tales of Monkey Island is things they bring to the table, you know.
Mm, sure. And I agree with what you say, that when you put it all together, this is going to come, this whole series is going to come across really well.
Yes.
It's just that at the moment, it's not all together. It's coming out in bits, and given the opportunity obligation, as it were, to scrutinize this episode individually, I found some aspects of it lacking. I think when I look back on the series as a whole, after giving it some breathing space, I am going to remember it very, very fondly.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, which is actually the case in a lot of games. You remember them fondly, and you remember them a bit more fondly than you do as you're playing them. But yeah, my 2 cents.
Yeah.
It's just really, I don't know, it's just amazing and awesome to have a new Monkey Island game.
Yay.
I'm still trying to digest. I think it's going to take me another year or so to fully digest that.
We'll be getting season 2 by then, so better hurry up and digest.
Is that something you guys would want, a season 2, like, so soon after this?
Well,
it almost seems,
I don't
like
know.
Monkey Island lends itself more to maybe installments that are spaced out a little bit.
Maybe you're saying this.
Yeah,
I almost get the, and you know, if they could do something at the level of quality that they've done, I would welcome it with open arms. But it almost seems like, how could you possibly sustain 2 games like that right after one another? It just seems like they would need to take a break for a while.
I would be fine with them doing that on the condition that they didn't do it in the same way that they did season 1 or 2 of Sam and Max, where one almost sort of ran into each other. They carried over in jokes and made sort of characters that were previously sort of minor characters but are now sort of integral to the series. If they did another season of Tales of Monkey Island, I'd want to see sort of all new characters and locations, and just set it up as a completely different story.
Yeah.
That doesn't follow on in any real significant way from the previous one.
If Telltale does make a second season, if that's what we want to call it, and they do make it soon, it would be the first time since the first two games that that happened.
Yeah.
You know, same team, same, I guess, overall aesthetic, same engine. It will be interesting to see how that would work again.
Yeah, and I kind of enjoy having a new look for each installment of Monkey Island. So it would be interesting to me if they decided to take the approach of, even though it would be more time-consuming and costly to them, if they would take the approach of actually giving the next season a new look.
Another thing to point out is that something, you know, among other things, something that Telltale has done really successfully with Tales is... they've successfully kind of rebooted the franchise. I mean, this is not a reboot of Monkey Island, but what I'm saying is they've managed to kind of break out a little of the formula and kind of... like, I feel like after Tales is over, you will get the sense that we can... like, Guybrush's next adventure could kind of be anything.
Yeah.
You know, it won't be tied to necessarily the same conventions that maybe the series was at the beginning. The first scene in the first episode of Tales in Monkey Island is sort of like a comment on that in a weird way. Like, you know, Guybrush is, you know, the scene with LeChuck, he's got the lane capture and he's about to do some crazy voodoo thing and Guybrush has to thwart it. It almost seemed like a parody of the other games in the sense that it's like, oh, it's going to be another one of these again, but then it turns out that was just the real story is about to begin.
You know, there's a lot of that in this one, where the when the trial starts and Guybrush walks, like, Guybrush Threepwood, you've been accused of four crimes, and somebody in the jury goes, four? I thought they'd be three, which is a reference, which was making fun of Telltale's tendency to give you three puzzles, and
the adventure game tendency to do it. They've done that before as well. I think there were a couple of jokes, actually, like that in Telltale games.
I missed that joke, actually, but now that you've said it, I like it, and I'm going to watch it out for it next time I play the game.
Yeah, those are funny bits when the jury, it's not the jury, but when the crowd is commenting in the courtroom, the little moments.
Yeah.
And the judge shuts them up.
Actually, I do think that's also why they went with six ingredients and not three, to sort of break out of that. That's just my theory. I have no evidence to support it, but one thing I just wanted to say, this might be a little random because I know this is getting a little long now, but what's really interesting is seeing Flotsam at night being as beautiful as it is in the day. And I was wondering if it was specifically designed to be that way. Like, did these pick colors that looked beautiful during, you know, with sunlight or without it? And I think that's interesting.
I don't know what I want to say. Go ahead, Peter.
I think that they were always aiming to have a gradual transition of sort of day scenes to night scenes as the series went on.
Yeah.
I think that was a very explicit design goal, and there are hints of that when you read interviews and things like that. And I just think that when they were looking to design to rejig Flotsam for night, they took cues from the first two games as to the sort of color schemes to use, because it is very reminiscent of them. I mean, I know this screenshot was sort of a mock-up, because it turns out it happens differently in the game, but when you look at the screenshot of Guybrush and Elaine doing the dancing in with the night background, the colours there, the yellows in the window and the blue of the buildings and the night sky, you could probably look at the palette and find that it's very close to the colors that were used in, say, Melee Island in the first game. So I just think that they just had a very good art direction in what they were doing there, and they chose their color palette very carefully.
Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of effort involved in doing that, but I also think Telltale's just having some fun with the fact that they actually have the freedom to kind of change the play around with the time and the scenery with night and day, because in the previous games that would have meant like redrawing a painting, you know, like Curse of Monkey Island. You had Plunder Island during the daytime and Blood Island during the nighttime, and like the only time you ever see any kind of like transition happening is I think in that cutscene where the storm brews during the journey to Blood Island. They kind of had to do that during a cutscene. So it is really fun and interesting to watch the backgrounds, and, you know, how they can kind of go from sundown to...
And Telltale are more clever at this than people give them credit for as well, because I'm sure that a lot of people will be saying things like, oh, they've been saying how they wanted a game that was set at night, and Telltale has finally answered their prayers, but actually... they've been planning this whole thing from the outset. They know full well, because they've got people working in that team who are not only fans of Monkey Island, but people who have really researched Monkey Island and looked into what makes the atmosphere of those games work. And there's no doubt in my mind that they knew from almost the very beginning that they wanted to, as the arc of the series goes on, get to this kind of atmosphere that's presented in episode 4.
This is tangentially related, but I was wondering, I was curious if the designers actually had an approximation of how long Tales of Monkey Island is in duration in game world time, because they make reference to, it's been weeks since this happened. I spent a few nights in the bowels of a manatee. I'm wondering if there's any sort of understanding of,
how long the story's taking.
How much time has passed? Yeah, how much time has passed?
It's.
I don't know.
It's a valid point because, well, it does at least take place over 3 months, because, like, it might just be a slight reference to the episodic format, but.
Right.
But, you know, the note, the courtroom in the first game, the first chapter was, it did say that the judge will be back in 3 months. And actually, I just wanted to see something about the judge.
I thought it was
really funny how Telltale,
I think we lost them.
Like, the belief on the fact that they're recycling models, and how, like, you walk into Club 41 and you never ever suspect that it's,
solid.
What now?
Like anything else with Mojo, this podcast is solid as a
Jason?
Rock.
Oh, he's gone now.
Okay. Well, we've been talking for quite a while, so maybe it is. Maybe that was fate telling us to shut the hell up.
We were going to talk about some other things, but I think we're going to save that. Obviously, since we did the last podcast, Brutal Legend came out, and at some point we will talk about that. And some other interesting things will be going on, of course, soon. I think this week Telltale have their announcement of what's happening next for them.
Yes, and of course, CSI Hard Evidence, not Hard Evidence, Deadly Intent came out on Friday, or Tuesday.
Indeed.
Tuesday.
And you'll be reviewing that.
Yes. So there's a lot of
games
came out. I'm struggling to keep up with them. I'm only about halfway through Brutal Legend myself. I love it so far, though.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. But we will have that discussion when there is more time.
So, all right.
Until then.
Yes. Bye, everybody. See you next time. And. Rest in peace, Chris.
Yeah, and Crumbs apparently as well.